session. Judge Brian, Judge Ross, and Judge Bjorkman, the Honorable Judge Brian presiding. We're now calling case A20-0422 in the matter of EDM versus SJM and NNN.
Good morning, counsel. Let me start by thanking you for being willing to participate remotely today and wanting to make sure that you can hear me and that we can hear you, and same for the other judges. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
Great.
Yes, sir.
Judge Bjorkman, would you mind saying a few words so we can make sure we're hearing you okay?
Yes, I am here. Good morning.
Judge Ross?
Good morning.
And Ms. Rotering?
Good morning.
Mr. Hunstad?
Good morning.
All right, wonderful. If there are problems, please let us know right away so we can stop, repeat ourselves. Also, sometimes we have unexpected interruptions, and I thank you in advance for your patience. If there are any doorbells or pets or family members in the background or technical glitches, we'll do the best we can to limit these during our conversations this morning. The last thing I will note is that the clock is on the screen that should be labeled Marshall. And sometimes you have to toggle between the active speaker view and the gallery view in order to see that clock. So if you're in active speaker, that means the person's talking is in the large picture and everybody else is kind of thumbnail size across the top or the bottom. But if you move to gallery view, then you'll see everybody kind of Brady Bunch style at all times. And you should be able to see the clock in that view pretty clearly. So if you have any questions about that, we can address that before we begin. Do you have any questions, counsel?
No, Your Honor.
No questions, Your Honor.
All right. Great. Well, again, thank you very much. And why don't we begin with argument from appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Andrew Hunstad, the attorney for the appellant. This appeal comes before you today after a order for dismissal in a parentage action in district court. In that case, the order for dismissal was issued before an appearance, before a hearing, and before genetic testing could be completed. Appellant contends that the district court committed a reversible error by failing to properly analyze and consider the Minnesota Parentage Act. We seek a reversal back to district court to allow this action to proceed. Instead of consuming my time discussing the various issues I prepared in the brief, I would like to focus on the dispositive issue, and that's the court's failure to order a genetic test. In the order for dismissal, the court does not actually address the genetic test that was requested by the appellant when he filed a motion for genetic testing along with his complaint for paternity. The district court failed to reference or analyze this issue or cite any authority warranting a denial of a genetic test. There is statutory authority requiring or mandating a genetic test in parentage actions, and that's 257.62, which states—
Mr. Hunstad, that's my question. I mean, it seems to me that the denial of the petition for genetic testing really goes hand in hand with the sua sponte dismissal of the parentage action. I mean, if we agree with you that that was error, the dismissal of the action, then wouldn't we remand the question of genetic testing and all the other issues you raise in your brief?
Yes. I mean, this is the key issue here in the case is the denial of that genetic test. Which under statute is required when a party brings forth an action and requests the genetic test. The court actually does not have the ability to deny a genetic or a blood test, provided that the party requesting the test completes an affidavit that alleges, at least in this case, paternity, and that there was the requisite a reasonable possibility that the parties engaged in the requisite sexual contact. And in this case, the appellant submitted an affidavit to the court at the same time he filed his complaint that says that he believes himself to be the biological father of the child, and that he engaged in sexual intercourse with respondent Miller. He meets that relatively low threshold that the statute dictates, and because he satisfies that precondition of the statute, the court was required to order that genetic test. This is actually an issue that this court in a different panel addressed in 2002 in the case called Friesen v. Bacala. Just so the record's clear, that's 653 Northwest 2nd Edition 199. And in that case, the alleged father filed a paternity action. The district court denied his motion for a blood test and he appealed. The Court of Appeals held that the district court committed an error by citing or making that denial based off of credibility issues of his affidavit, and that the alleged father asserted sufficient grounds to establish the requisite sexual contact that had occurred between the parties and that he was entitled to that blood test. And in that case, the Court of Appeals reversed and remanded back to district court. This was also addressed by the Supreme Court of Minnesota in 2002 in a case called Witzo v. Overvey. And in that case, the alleged father brought forth a parentage action against a woman and her husband. Mother and her husband moved to dismiss the action for lack of standing, but the district court denied their request and ordered genetic testing. The married couple in that case appealed, and the Minnesota Supreme Court held that the alleged father could bring his action to determine whether or not he was the biological father, even if there was already a presumed father in that case.
Mr. Hunza, that leads to a question in my mind is, are you challenging the district court's determination that the respondent, NNN, is a presumed parent because she was married to SJM at the time of the child's birth?
So that is another issue that, yes, was erased in the brief. So we are also alleging that the court erred in designating the other respondent as a presumptive parent. Minnesota statutes does allow for a mother to bring forth a parentage action to establish the mother and child relationship. The parent-child relationship does incorporate that mother and child relationship in the statutory definition. But there is one caveat in the statute, 257.71, and it states that insofar as practical, the provisions of the Parentage Act that apply to the father-child relationship also apply to the mother-child relationship. So the statute doesn't actually explain or provide any context as to what insofar as practical means. But if we look at the legislative intent, which was previously examined in the matter of CMG, the court acknowledged that when this act was established in 1980, that the primary purpose was to identify the biological father and to adjudicate that individual as the legal father. Now, a lot has changed since 1980.
And I want to stop you right now before we get too far down the legislative history road. I mean, are you contending that any of the statutes at issue here are ambiguous and that would require interpretation and review of legislative history?
Specifically, yes, specifically 257.71.
What about the district court, as you recall, in the amended order, specifically said that based on statute 517.201, we would look at the statute that creates presumptions of paternity. with a neutral gender lens or through a neutral gender lens. And so subdivision one would be read to say a person is presumed to be the biological parent of a child if the person, among other things, was married to the biological mother. Seems to me that that's not an ambiguous reading of that statute, or that statute is not ambiguous. Do you agree with that?
Not necessarily, because even if we apply that rule from 517201, that does not remove the reference to the biological relationship. That biological relationship is still cited throughout the chapter, and we still define the parent-child relationship as the legal relationship between a child and the biological parent or adoptive parent. And that the parent-child relationship is either established or it is established by giving birth, So the parent-child relationship is between the child and the biological parent, and that's established by giving birth or through this chapter, or it's established by the adoptive parent showing proof of the adoption.
And yet our court has specifically held, have we not, that, you know, the termination of a legal parent is not simply a matter of biology. Didn't we say that in the Blackwell case from back in 2011? A legal adjudication of paternity is not controlled by biology. This court has already held that. Isn't that what you're asking us to do?
No, what I'm asking the court to do is examine the statute in its entirety. We can't ignore the word the biological relationship that is already in the statute. But if we look back to 257.71, where it says to the extent or insofar as practical, we are asking, the question becomes, is it practical to extend a presumption of a biological relationship or a rebuttable presumption of a biological relationship to a party who has acknowledged that she is not the biological parent and that she acknowledges another party is the biological parent?
Just to be clear, you're suggesting that phrase, insofar as practical, is the ambiguous terminology?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what exactly is ambiguous about that the language? I understand that it might have different applications and there may be different ways to apply and determine what is or what is not practical, but what exactly is ambiguous about the term that you assert needs interpretation?
The extent of the application of that term is what is the ambiguous aspect of that statute.
So the language is not ambiguous at all?
Yes.
So why would we need to look at legislative history then if the language is not ambiguous? If we know what the statute says and we know what the words mean, isn't that the threshold question for determining whether a statute is ambiguous or not?
Well, regardless, if we look at the legislative intent of this particular statute, we still have the reference to the biological relationship. That still is something that the court must consider.
No, I understand that. I'm just trying to get a sense of whether we dig around in legislative history or not. I'm not yet clear why you believe that's necessary. What is the terminology in the statute that you believe requires insight into what the legislature was thinking?
I guess, Your Honor, that would just go back to the application of that that specific sentence to the rest of the chapter, as it relates to whether or not what specific provisions of the chapter are entitled to that application for the mother-child relationship. So, in conclusion, the dispositive issue in this case is the court denying the genetic test, dismissing the action before the appellant had the opportunity to be heard by the court, denying him all access to allowing him to proceed in this action. I would ask that this court reverse and remand this matter back to the district court, and I would reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, I don't see other questions, so we'll move on to Ms. Rotering.
Good morning. If it please the court, my name is Amy Rotering. I represent respondent Gowo NASA, and we respectfully request that the court affirm the district court's decision. This case is simple. It asks the court to address the issue of standing. Does the appellant have standing to initiate a paternity action under Minnesota Statute 257 when custody, parenting time, and child support for the child in question was already adjudged in the child's legal parent's dissolution?
And let me stop you right there. The stipulated dissolution judgment, as I look at it, doesn't make a finding as to parentage. It makes determinations with respect to legal and physical custody and parenting time, but can you point me to some aspect of that document that establishes parentage?
Well, it establishes parentage in the sense that the parties who are divorcing are stating that they are the parents of the child. And when read through 517-201, in this case, we have a same-sex couple who's divorcing. It relates to statute 257-66, which says that a final judgment is determinative in this matter, and that the issues of parenting time, child support, and custody are required to be a part of a marriage dissolution when it's applicable.
And again, when I look at the judgment itself, I don't find that conclusive district court determination. So just assuming that I'm right about that, just for the sake of my next question, what legal authority would support the district court's sua sponte dismissal of a parentage action by a man who claims to be the biological father when, as I read the applicable statute, there is no timeline under which the alleged biological father has to initiate that proceeding?
Appellate courts in Minnesota have dismissed paternity matters under the doctrine of re judicata when there has been a marriage dissolution prior to the application for paternity. And the court has decided that paternity matter cannot move forward. And I do have a couple of cases that
Is that as to non-parties or only as to the parties to the dissolution?
To non-parties, Your Honor. And actually, in the two cases that I would like to cite, it's actually the parties themselves that were not allowed to move forward.
Well, that would make sense for res judicata to apply. Party status is one of those elements of res judicata. So, have you found any cases where this court or the Supreme Court has applied the same res judicata principle to non-parties?
I have not, Your Honor. The cases that I found were from the 80s. They're still good law, but no, I have not. However,
well, they may be good law. I'm just wondering why you believe they apply.
Because it is a claim preclusion. Certainly if a party cannot bring another claim against that's already been decided, then a non-party could not as well.
And what would be the legal principle that supports that notion that when a party is precluded from bringing a claim under res judicata, a non-party is also precluded. What's the legal support for that?
Well, the fact situation in those cases did involve a party, but that the point of those cases was that finding a fact that the children are the minor children of a party is re judicata, and it bars further litigation of the issue.
My question is, what legal support do you have for your proposition that although res judicata bars parties in later raising claims, it also bars non-parties who were not participants in prior litigation? What's the authority for that?
My understanding from the case law that I read was that in this particular case, the holding was not because you are a party to the matter, you're prohibited from moving forward. It was the fact that the decision had already been made with regard to the minor children. That was the main point of those cases. There's other statutes as well that would apply. Now, the district court obviously did not specifically cite to specific case law or statute when they made it their ruling, but it is supported by Minnesota Statute 518.145 that says that a ruling is final and cannot be reopened short of certain circumstances. And again, 257.66, that the judgment is determinative for all matters. The other issue that I'd like to address with regard to Witzel versus Overby that the appellant brings up. There's three key differences between Witzel versus Overby and in this case. The first key difference is at the time of Witzel, same-sex marriage was not legal in Minnesota as it is now. As the court has talked about, pursuant to 257.55 subdivision 1A, read through the lens of 517.201, respondent NASA is legally recognized presumed parent as the child was born during the marriage. At least she was the presumed parent during the marriage. And she's still the presumed parent.
Isn't EDM also a presumed parent, as the district court found under 257.55 subdivision 1, because according to the parentage complaint, he had, you know, held the child out as his own?
That's part of 257.55 subdivision 1D, but the other part that's equally as important is that he's required to receive the child into his home, which
right. And
he has not done.
That I believe he alleged that in his complaint, but again, because the court dismissed this action before it went anywhere, there wasn't an opportunity to submit an affidavit. My question, though, is, isn't this a case involving conflicting presumptions under 257.55?
I don't believe it is, Your Honor. I do believe that it's a question of standing, because he has not, like you said, the case is not developed enough. It was more further developed in the respondent's divorce matter that it was understood from the beginning when this child was conceived that the respondents were going to be the parents of this child. And statute 517.201 is key in this argument, because when the legislature passed that statute, I mean, they understood, presumably, that two women cannot conceive a child on their own with their own genetic material, and two men cannot do so.
Ms. Rotering, I guess I'm having a little trouble seeing how this is not just a simple competing presumptions case like we see many times. For the district court to be correct, wouldn't we have to have some binding law or authority that says post-dissolution, there's no such thing as a parentage action from a non-party? And we're not even getting into gender neutral yet. It seems like that's the only kind of case law that would support what the district court did by dismissing the case. And I'm not aware of case law or statutory authority that says post-dissolution, there is no such thing as a parentage action.
This could be a matter of first impression, Your Honor. It certainly could. And I know that 517.201 has not been interpreted, to my knowledge, by an appellate court.
Let me turn to that then. What is it about gender neutral language that would require us in this case to say for same-sex couples, the presumption that might be available to a biological father, genetic father, is not available in same-sex couples based on the gender-neutral requirement, right? What is it about that provision requiring us to read this in a gender-neutral way that eliminates this presumption when it comes to same-sex couples, but doesn't eliminate it when it comes to opposite-sex couples?
It's because there's never going to be a situation in a same-sex marriage where the parties to that marriage create the child on their own without outside genetic material. That's the difference between...
But that's true for lots of married couples, same-sex and opposite-sex.
Right. It is true, Your Honor, but in this
I guess that's what I'm saying. Is the distinction fertility or infertility or some inability to conceive or to procreate? Is that what makes this presumption, takes it off the table in a competing presumption case?
I think what takes it off the table is, first of all, the notion that we already talked about how we do not believe that he received the child into his home, but the underlying issue is permanency and best interest of the child.
Again, but that's what the jury, not the district court, because you have a right to a jury trial in paternity cases. So potentially a jury would be weighing those best interests. And at some point, that's what a competing presumption case is. But you're saying we don't get there because we don't concern ourselves with this competing presumption based on gender neutral language. And I guess I don't understand what it is about that would eliminate the otherwise applicable biological presumption in this case.
Well, because I mean, as we've moved along in society, we've moved away from strictly biological or adoptive parents being legal parents. I mean, the case that Mr. Hunstad quoted in Re Welfare of CMG, paternity was awarded to a man who was not the child's biological father. We are living in a society that is moving beyond biology. And if every, you know, if the chances, if we go with what we've been doing, the chances of same-sex couples, their parenthood being challenged is going to go up dramatically because it is a given that one of them is not going to be the biological parent. And I believe that the
Why is that a concern for us in this case? That I mean, you may be correct, but that just may be a circumstance of the changes that you've suggested have occurred in society. But why is that a problem for us to try to resolve in this case, that we may have more litigation, or litigation may be more available to biological parents?
Because it opens the door for alleged fathers to come and challenge this bond that these families have established in their marriage. I mean, 517-201 applies only to married couples. And so it's going to open the door to more lawsuits. And so as far as this case is concerned, we believe that there was no presumed fatherhood. At the time of the divorce, Mr. Morgan was not an alleged parent. The parents of this child are the respondents. And that was well understood by all of the parties.
I think to come back to Judge Ross's question, one of the things that makes practicing in a family law area so interesting is that society is changing and our understanding of what it means to be a parent, a mother, a father, changes. And sometimes the law is lagging behind kind of our social norms. And this may be one of those circumstances, but the law still is in place. So what is it that is for us to decide when the legislature has retained a biological presumption?
Well, unfortunately, the legislature does have some catching up to do with the Parentage Act, that there's still some talk about biology, but again, 517-201 addresses that directly, with the understanding that one of the parents in a marriage is not going to be the biological parent, yet they still should be treated the same as opposite sex couples. However, because of the fact, again, that one of the parents is never going to be the biological parent, that is going to cause that, or that could very well cause instability in Minnesota families if these third parties can come in.
Or it creates an incentive for the parents to go through an adoption process.
Well, we don't expect, I'm sorry, yes, Your Honor, I hear you. However, we don't expect husbands to adopt their children within a marriage. We don't ask opposite sex divorcing couples to cite to statute 257, as Mr. Hunstad states in his brief. So we are discriminating against same-sex couples by expecting them to adopt their children within a marriage.
How is that so? I mean, how is that discrimination that is improper discrimination? There is a biological bond that's recognized as a constitutional right of parental rights based upon a biological bond. That's not changed by changes in society. The fact that there are additional ways that a person may become a parent doesn't diminish an individual's right, mother or father, to establish parentage, biological parentage. And it may be that there are additional burdens imposed on those who come at parenting from a different basis. But I'm not sure why it is that you're suggesting, I think implicitly, that this is somehow an improper distinction or improper burden on one group and not the other. But again, going back to Judge Brian's question, it doesn't seem to me that these are issues we have to resolve. Perhaps the argument that you're presenting is one that you would make to the legislature, but I'm not sure that your argument at least doesn't persuade me that we should approach the statute any differently now as it's written.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree. I do think that the legislature through 517-201, I think maybe they just didn't want to go through the trouble of changing the entire Parentage Act to accommodate same-sex couples.
So we're supposed to do that as a matter of the court's supposed to step in and do that because the legislature didn't want to go through the trouble?
What I'm doing is asking the court to interpret 517-201 to mean that same-sex couples are recognized as a valid family unit. The statute not only protects the rights and responsibilities of spouses, but also their children.
I know we're out of time.
I'm sorry. I didn't do that on purpose. I apologize.
I'll let you conclude with some final words here. Go ahead.
Okay. In conclusion, Your Honor, we are asking that the Court of Appeals affirm the decision of the court, of the district court. Thank you.
Great. Mr. Hunstad.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll be brief. The appellant has standing. In his complaint, he acknowledges that he held the child out as his own biological child, welcomed the child into his house. There is nothing in the record right now that is inconsistent with that. Secondly, depending on the results of the genetic test that he should have been able to have, there could be a evidentiary presumption that he is the biological father of the child. Of course,
I agree with you, Mr. Hunstad, but if you read further into statute 257.62, the legislature said that even such a determination, the evidentiary presumption based on genetic testing, does not preclude the adjudication of another person as the legal parent under section 557.55. As I read that, it seems to me to support the district court's determination that NNN is also a presumed parent in this case by virtue of her marriage to the biological mother at the time of the child's birth. Why am I wrong about that, Mr. Hunstad?
Well, just for purposes of clarification, you're asking why I think you're wrong about the application of the presumption of parentage.
Right. I'm just saying when the legislature has said that even an evidentiary presumption flowing from, you know, a 99% or greater likelihood that a alleged father is in fact the biological father, that even with that evidence, it still does not preclude the adjudication that someone else is the father, read, parent of that child under the other presumptions that the legislature has established.
Right. And I raise this issue just to address the purpose of standing. Whether this court determines I'm wrong on that particular issue that you raise, I will leave it up to the three of you. But the appellant in this case does have standing to proceed. He does cite the holdout provision, and depending on that genetic test that he has met, the mandatory genetic test, which he has met the requirements for, could also provide him another avenue to proceed. But I also wanted to address the judgment and decree. The judgment and decree does not have the language of establishing parentage. It just simply isn't there. And a paternity action, a parentage action is not determinative on the marital status of the parties. A third party can be adjudicated as a parent of a child born from a married couple. So the language just isn't there to constitute an adjudication. And even if it was an adjudication, the parties were required to provide notice to anybody that they believed to be a biological parent. There's a requirement in the statute. That did not happen. My client, the appellant, did not know that the divorce proceeding involved the welfare of the child. The parties were to provide notice if it was an adjudication of parentage, but it's not. The language isn't there. So I ask the court to remand this back to district court so this matter can proceed. I rest my time.
Well, there's still a little bit of time left. I'm going to pick up on something that Judge Ross had asked Ms. Rotering. And it occurs to me that when the legislature has passed a provision regarding interpretation of other provisions, that this court is going to have to struggle with how to affect the new statutory canon of construction. If, for example, in this case, we have the requirement that we interpret terms in a gender neutral way, but the statute itself didn't change. It's up to us to then essentially amend provisions of the statute. What happens if there's two different ways to read in a gender neutral manner a provision? What's the court supposed to do in that sense, in that circumstance?
That is a very good question. Is there a specific provision you have in mind, or is just for purposes of clarification so I can answer your question?
I'll put it more precisely, and I do see that we're out of time. You had raised in your argument, pointed out what you thought was ambiguous about one phrase. My question is, if the legislature passes a specific statutory canon of construction, that canon of construction itself could be applied in two different ways, and we say it's ambiguous, are we to look at the legislative intent behind the entire statute, or more precisely the legislative intent just behind the amendment?
Well, with regard specifically to 517, 201, I don't actually think that provision actually has much consequence in terms of how we interpret the parentage action based upon the language that is already in 257.71, applying, allowing a mother-child action to proceed. It only makes it gender neutral, but it, insofar as practical, we're already reading it in a gender neutral manner. So I would say in terms of determining legislative intent, I guess we've both could be considered. I don't imagine, but I imagine we would have to give deference to 257.71, the actual legislative intent of that section.
Okay. Are there other questions? I don't see any, so I want to thank the parties again, and we will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory timeframe. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.